Chapter 16. The First and Last International Workshop on XMRV, and the World's Most Celebrated Virus Hunter Enters the Fray. When Ian Lipkin chose a career in infectious diseases, he envisioned hunting for pathogens in daring treks around the world. Though disappointed to learn that modern-day virus hunters work largely from the lab, he still wound up as a pioneer. Lipkin has developed groundbreaking techniques that have helped a new generation of disease detectives sleuth out the infectious roots of mystery ills, chronic disease, and neuropsychiatric disorders like autism and OCD. Discover, May 11, 2012. Dr. Mikovits did not have a clear idea when the planning first began for what was later dubbed the First International Workshop on XMRV, scheduled for September 7th and 8th, 2010. She was sure that organizing took at least 6 months, and first invitation letters were emailed April 21st, 2010. The decision to have it must have been made sometime in the winter of 2009 to 2010. Probably when the controversy about XMRV in humans was really crystallizing. The confirmation study by Lowe and Alter was probably not yet known to the organizers, and thus it was initially set up to focus overwhelmingly on the negative studies that had generated the post-science controversy. The conference was organized by familiar players through a group in the Netherlands. John Coffin, Stuart Legris, Robert Silverman, Jonathan Stoy, a Coffin protege from the UK, and Charles Boucher from Holland. Frank Rossetti was originally invited to speak, but he protested to Silverman and Legris that neither Mikovits nor Singh were invited to present, which seemed an unsightly omission, since they had done the most important work since Silverman. Rossetti, ever the cynic, saw their lack of inclusion as evidence of the old boys' club, anti-feminist power infrastructure in science. Annette Whittemore was also upset when she saw the proposed lineup of speakers and wanted to immediately mobilize the patient groups to start a blitzkrieg of protests. Mikovits vetoed that idea and proposed a different course of action. She contacted anybody she had worked with in the field whom she knew had positive data similar to her own and asked them to submit an abstract. She had a whole list of giant minds in this category. There was Dr. David Bell, the gentleman doctor who had visited some of his rural patients on horseback and had been treating ME/CFS patients for more than 20 years since encountering a pediatric outbreak in upstate New York. Paul Cheney, the groundbreaker of the Incline Village outbreak, Dr. Julio Blanco and his team from Barcelona, Spain, Dr. Jose Montoya of Stanford University, who had great compassion and a fiercely investigative attitude toward ME/CFS, Dr. Michael Snyderman, an oncologist who had tested positive for the antibody to XMRV and chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, and had been treating himself with antiretroviral medications, which, as he documented, had put his cancer into remission. Mikovits recalled the response of those she contacted being very gracious and supportive. Eventually, 11 or 12 abstracts from researchers with positive reports about XMRV were submitted for presentation at the conference. While an abstract lacks the influence of a peer-reviewed paper published in a top journal, it is usually a good indicator of where the field is going, and thus an integral part of future funding strategies concerning a given scientific topic. The organizers of the conference had little choice but to respond to this influx of abstracts, although their decisions didn't always seem to make sense. The only positive abstract submitted that was given a speaking spot was the one submitted by Mikovits entitled Detection of Infectious XMRV in the Peripheral Blood of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Patients in the United Kingdom. Mikovits was also invited to chair the fourth roundtable discussion on ME/CFS with John Coffin, as well as participate as a panel member in a question-and-answer session that would be webcast around the world. But it was the research Mikovits presented on ME/CFS patients in the United Kingdom that would provoke the greatest firestorm. It even attracted the attention of Dr. Francis Collins, the head of the National Institutes of Health. After that, a very different Battle of Britain began. In 2002, Dr. Jonathan Kerr was the Sir Joseph Hotung Clinical Senior Lecturer in Inflammation, as well as the Honorable Consultant in Microbiology at St. George's University in London. But in 2010, he suddenly left research for private practice. His career downgrade raised the question whether Kerr was like other historical researchers who stumbled upon inconvenient truths and found their careers suddenly jeopardized. In 2008, Kerr authored what was billed as a major article in the Journal of Infectious Disease, Gene Expression Subtypes in Patients with CFS-ME. As explained in the article, the goal of this study was to determine the precise abnormalities of gene expression in the blood of patients with CFS-ME. Using this approach, we identified differential expression of 88 human genes in patients with CFS-ME. Among these genes, highly represented functions were hematological disease and function, immunological disease and function, cancer, cell death, immune response, and virus infection. To fully appreciate the importance of this information, it's probably necessary to make a brief detour into the field of epigenetics, which had been turning a standard Darwinian understanding of evolution and genetics on its head. In the typical Darwinian understanding of evolution and genetics, an animal either has a trait, or the recessive trait for the gene, or it doesn't. What happens to an organism during its lifetime has no effect on the genetic inheritance it passes down to its young. In other words, these traits stay fixed. The classic demonstration of this principle is that rats who have their tails cut off give birth to offspring with tails. What's being discovered in epigenetics, which means on top of genes, is that diet, daily stresses, even toxins can turn gene functions on or off like switches, making us more susceptible to disease or infection. Because of her expertise in epigenetics, Mikovits was immediately intrigued by Kerr's interesting work. Kerr's group found that among the well-defined CFS-ME population, there was abnormal activity in 88 of their genes. It was as if their internal switchboard had gone mad. Genes of people with CFS-ME were behaving in a radically different way than those of healthy individuals. The data had significance not only for ME/CFS, but also for Gulf War illness, GWI, a related controversial disease. One gene in Kerr's studies, NTE, is the primary site of action of organophosphate, OP, compounds, such as sarin nerve gas, one of the agents some GWI veterans were exposed to during deployment, and organophosphates are also used regularly in civilian life as pesticides, which causes axonal degeneration and paralysis due to inactivation of its serine esterase activity. In the nervous system of adult chickens, OP-modified NTE initiates neurodegeneration. NTE probably regulates neuron-glial interactions during development and possibly also during adult life. Exposure to OPs may thus trigger CFS-ME and Gulf War illness. Kerr had crossed a red line by suggesting that some type of chemical exposure, like organophosphates in sarin and in widespread civilian use, might be affecting gene expression, particularly those genes involved in brain function and proper regulation of the immune system. In such an environment of abnormal gene expression as the result of a chemical exposure, was it beyond imagination that a previously suppressed retrovirus might cause havoc? A chemical exposure, followed by changes in gene expression, could lead to the increased ability of a previously suppressed retrovirus to do harm. Since the immune system was faulty due to changes in gene expression, it would be hard to say whether it was the immune system, the chemicals, or the retrovirus doing the greatest amount of damage. The picture looked like a wrong place, wrong time breakdown caused by multiple and possibly synergistic factors. Because of his research and reputation for being precise yet low-key, Kerr was a natural fit for Mikovits. They wrote an application as multiple principal investigators for a federal grant, known as an R01 grant, to study pathogens and patterns of gene expression in ME/CFS patients. Submitting their first proposal in June of 2007, they were awarded the grant in September of 2009 after two revisions. It was the first federal grant the WPI received. However, if one of the principal investigators in such a study loses his or her academic association, the grant may be recalled unless another researcher from the same institution can step in, or it can be shown that the remaining investigator can fulfill the research objectives. Mikovits was surprised when Kerr was not given tenure at St. George's University. After that, his name suddenly appeared on a negative XMRV study. An ME/CFS parent named Chris Cairns, who wrote a blog with the handle The CFS Patient Advocate, His Daughter Has CFS, chronicled the veering course of Kerr over the years in a June 9, 2010 post. While he was not in a position to know exactly what happened to Kerr, Cairns normally attended many of the scientific meetings on ME/CFS and was a jovial colleague to many of the researchers. His article was a window into the puzzling change in Kerr. It also reflected concerns of the patient community that something unusual and potentially sinister was happening in the research. Cairns was formerly professor of fine arts at Haverford College and was honored by the WPI on September 14, 2011 as Advocate of the Year, 2 weeks before Mikovits was fired. Kerr begins by noting that the expectation had built through 2009 that something big was going to come out of the WPI, and then in October of 2009, the XMRV research was published. Cairns noted that Kerr seemed to disappear after that. Then his name was tacked onto a strangely negative validation study of XMRV. Then came the Invest in ME conference in May of 2010, and the strangeness continued. Jonathan Kerr was invited to update his research at the Invest in ME conference in May 2010. He was not in attendance as the conference began and came in halfway through the morning. He gave a very short lecture where he turned away from the microphone towards the slides on the screen and talked in his usual inaudible voice. No one could hear anything he was saying. Despite his apparent reputation as a soft-spoken mumbler, Kerr was well respected in both the scientific and patient communities prior to 2010, viewed by the patient community as one of the researchers who honestly searched for answers to their condition. That sharply changed in 2010, as Cairns continued to describe what seemed like erratic behavior by Kerr at the 2010 Invest in ME conference in London. A woman asked a question, and Kerr turned away from the microphone as he spoke. His slides were bleached out. At the end of his talks, he usually talked effusively about his research help. This time, he showed a slide with a picture of a group greatly diminished in number, then mentioned his research was funded by the ME Trust, a group that was suspected by many in the community as pushing a psychiatric explanation for their disease. Cairns continued, "To this observer, it was obvious that Dr. Kerr was embarrassed and did not want to be at this conference. His entire manner and presentation, or lack of presentation, spoke of him just wanting to disappear. He was noticeably not interacting as in the past. He seemed like dead weight, and psychologically half his size." For Cairns, who had seen Kerr present a number of times, this was truly unconventional behavior. The picture Cairns painted was of a scientist under some kind of psychological siege. Cairns asked how it had all come to this and suggested his own explanation. It had been obvious from the beginning that Dr. Kerr's CFSME gene work did not win approval from his colleagues in the UK. The writing was on the wall, and things obviously got hotter for him when he collaborated with this rogue agency in the US, this WPI place. And then XMRV hit the fan, and that was enough for Dr. Kerr's colleagues. They pulled the plug on him. In various countries, they put polonium-210 in the soup. In the UK, they just give the poison pill in a collegial manner. I imagine that Kerr always expected that something bad was going to happen. So he must not have been surprised when the late-night call came, or someone cornered him in the hallway of his tiny research facility, urging him to disassociate himself from those people. This friendly fellow or gal, a fully supportive, honest soul, must have said to him, "John, pull yourself together. Just take this pill. Just take this poison pill. Swallow it with a full glass of water." While Cairns's suspicions about what had happened to Kerr, that is, his allegation that someone offered a metaphorical poison pill, could not be confirmed, the events complicated the federal grant he had been awarded jointly with Mikovits. Mikovits knew she was on a short timeline to save the grant, and wouldn't let it go without a fight. Prior to Kerr's failure to get tenure, they had collected most of the controls they needed, but hadn't made the arrangements to get the patient samples. They needed those samples desperately if they were going to have any chance of retaining their grant and finishing the research. Mikovits called Phlebotomy Services International, a company that hired people to draw blood around the world and knew about grants and institutions, medical protocols, security, and performing work under the Institutional Review Board rules that covered medical research. Mikovits explained to the founders of the company what she needed and begged for their help. The couple knew the importance of the project and offered to volunteer their time, but needed somebody to pay their plane fare to England and for a hotel and supplies they'd need for the job. Mikovits put $5,000 or $6,000 on her own American Express card to get them to England, and a generous, anonymous donor came up with the $5,000 they needed for supplies. Mikovits contacted some of the patient groups in the London area to determine if they could assist in shuttling patients to draw locations. Many patients would need a ride, and preferably from somebody who understood how taxing such a venture would be to a person with ME/CFS. The patient groups waged a heroic response, and were able to get nearly 50 ME/CFS patients in the very short few days that the phlebotomists were available. A handful of patients were too weak to travel, so one of the phlebotomists made a pilgrimage to their homes to get their samples. Other patients would likely have physical payback, so they were heroic in their efforts as well. After a panicked night when the samples were held up by FedEx, by the next day, all of the samples had made it to Frank Rossetti's lab at the National Cancer Institute and were waiting to be processed. Since questions had been raised that XMRV was simply mouse contamination, Mikovits wanted the samples to go directly to Frank's lab so he could arrange to have them processed in a facility that never handled mouse samples. This should have ended the contamination dispute. Mikovits believed they had taken all necessary steps to save the R01 grant, and that she could make a credible argument that Kerr's part in the study could be transferred to the WPI. Gerwin Morris was a member of the UK group of patients, and it was through an email to Mikovits about the possibility of getting into the study that he struck up a friendship with her. A chemist and microbiologist by training, he joined a couple of ME/CFS forums right before the science paper came out. He had very little difficulty unraveling the design of studies, and so he shared his expertise with the non-scientists on the forums. Morris had gotten sick with ME/CFS around 1971 to 1972, when he was a pubescent 14 years old, well over a decade before the first modern U.S. outbreak in 1984 to 1985. Over the years, he went through an oscillating pattern of recovery and illness, a pattern Cheney has noted is more common in pediatric cases, who often have recovery periods, sometimes consuming several years of his life. Morris was a vocal critic of the four negative studies right after the science paper, and in 2013 detailed his objections for this book. His concerns revolved around the difficulty of the PCR systems used in most of the negative studies, as PCR is a process known to be extremely sensitive to even slight variations in conditions. In an interview for this book, Morris discussed his concerns. If anybody believes or reads anything about MULV viruses, they will know that they don't come alone. A retrovirus never comes in one homologous sequence. It just doesn't. Not even if they replicate by something called clonal expansion, which most retroviruses do, with HIV being the exception, not the norm. So if you actually are going to target one particular sequence in your PCR assay, because the way they designed their assays was to calibrate or optimize them so that they could actually detect a low copy number of viral plasmids, VP62, and in sparkling brand new human DNA, that is, for a start, never, ever going to be anything like getting a virus out of biological sample and the various corruptions of DNA that can occur. Morris also thought the scientists were setting their sights on a too small bullseye, the VP62 clone of Silverman, rather than the broader sequences found by Mikovits and Lowe and Alter. You can't say for a fact that this PCR assay, which they replicated ad nauseam in all of the studies, could even detect a very slight variation on the VP62 clone. So it's fairly obvious that they weren't actually genuinely trying to find a retrovirus, in my view. I think they had already decided for one reason or another that VP62 was a contaminant, and they would only bother to look for examples of the contaminant. But by using the PCR testing they did, they were capable of detecting only VP62. And if one is totally honest about it, the way that retroviruses integrate into the CpG islands, their very high density of guanine and cytosine, cross-linked, which means they're very difficult to pull apart and re-anneal. And you have to have very special cycling conditions to be able to pick up anything in those regions. So even if they were looking for VP62, the virus, in my view, and in my background in biochemistry, they would not be able to detect it. But the basic question is whether you can be certain from the scientific level of certainty whether the virus you're looking for is in that sample, and that question was never answered. To put it in simpler terms, scientists have shown that false negatives, as well as false positives, can occur in PCR assays. He was also clear about what he considered Mikovits' strengths and weaknesses. She is one of the most honest, caring individuals I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. Her weakness, I think, is naivete. I don't think she can contemplate that other scientists are not quite as honest as her. And I don't think she can contemplate how rich and powerful interests can manipulate the population as a whole. And I don't think she can buy into the fact that she's been manipulated as well. Morris also voiced strong opinions about whether animal retroviruses were circulating in the human population. I think that there are gamma retroviruses out there. Vaccines were passed through animal tissue, like smallpox was passaged through mouse brains, before they knew anything about what they were doing. They were creating replication recombinant retroviruses with gay abandon in the early vector research, until they realized what they were doing. If there aren't some gamma retroviruses circulating in the human population, there bloody well ought to be. What I think the science results were, I think Judy might have been picking up an HERVW, which is a gamma retroviral HERV, human endogenous retrovirus, otherwise known as the multiple sclerosis retrovirus, because it was talked about as a cause of MS for the better part of 15 years. It's been around, but whether it's a primary cause or its activation is a secondary cause of pathology, I don't think anybody knows. I suspect that oxidatively modified envelope protein, a reaction in the cell to foreign proteins, could have triggered Judy's antibody test. Gerwin couldn't give a definitive identification of the current virus plaguing patients, but it was clear something of a viral nature was going on. Judy's results cannot be explained by contamination. The contamination occurring in her lab was just Fantasy Island. A lot of people would like to make the facts fit their theory, but they don't. The multiple lines of evidence in Judy and Frank's study demonstrates there's no way that's contamination. But Mikovits's lobbying to get positive data into the first international workshop on XMRV still paid off. More than 10 abstracts confirmed basic parts of the retroviral theory advanced by Mikovits. Maureen Hansen of Cornell University submitted one entitled XMRV in Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, a Pilot Study, in which she took 30 adult subjects, 10 with severe CFS, 10 who had recovered from the disorder, and 10 controls, and tested their blood. Markedly, even a significant number of ME/CFS patients identified as recovered showed evidence of XMRV. Hansen stated clearly in her abstract, "Our results corroborate those of Lombardi et al." Dr. B.P. Danielson from Baylor College of Medicine contributed, "XMRV infection of prostate cancer patients from the southern United States and analysis of possible correlates of infection." The abstract agreed with findings that XMRV did not seem to be correlated with the genetic defect in the RNase-L pathway suggested by Robert Silverman of the Cleveland Clinic. Tissue testing, which might find latent virus not as easily cleared from blood, seemed a key determinant in testing to the team from Baylor. From Emory University came more detailed evidence of the sequences of XMRV integrated into prostate cancer tissue, in Variant XMRVs in Clinical Prostate Cancer. This abstract concluded that clinical prostate cancer samples contain integrated XMRV proviral sequences, which can be amplified in nested PCR approaches with approximately 1,000 more bases than can be attributed to XMRV alone. Silverman and Dasgupta of the Cleveland Clinic weighed in with the positive finding of the presence of XMRV RNA in urine of prostate cancer patients. RNA is the messenger molecule of DNA and can be used to detect active infection. If a test were developed utilizing urine instead of blood or tissue, detection in men at risk of prostate cancer would be hugely simplified. Another abstract by Silverman explored XMRV and gene function. XMRV infection induces host genes that regulate inflammation and cellular physiology, and found that the chemokine IL-8 is one of the most highly induced genes in response to XMRV infection of prostate cancer cell line DU145. XMRV induction of the 30 host genes identified in this study suggests a profound effect of the virus on fundamental cellular physiology and inflammation. The Mikovits lab had also found that the chemokine IL-8 was the inflammatory marker most strongly correlated with XMRV infection, so they had located the same signature. The data that XMRV-affected genes were implicated in cancer was not surprising, but sobering. The researchers seemed to be slowly mapping the mechanism by which XMRV led to prostate cancer. Paul Chaney must have had the gratifying feeling of coming to the end of a long journey when he submitted his abstract. Many credited him for originally suggesting that a retrovirus underlies ME/CFS, although he modestly claimed that the media firestorm around AIDS would have put the seed in someone's mind eventually. Chaney's abstract, XMRV detection in a national practice specializing in chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, began with a historical recap. Then his conclusions corroborated Mikovits's work, and he asked the question of whether family members of ME/CFS patients were also at risk. He concluded, XMRV was detected in 74.5% of 47 consecutive cases of well-characterized CFS from 24 states and 2 countries. There is a high positivity rate, 50%, of XMRV in non-CFS exposure controls within family members. Patients reported significant illness in first-order family members. Troubling results also came from a collaboration between Emory University, the Cleveland Clinic, and Abbott Laboratories in the abstract, XMRV induces a chronic replicative infection in rhesus macaques tissue, but not in blood. This research found the virus seemed to disappear relatively quickly from the blood, but remained in tissue, where it could replicate to detectable levels upon immune stimulation. The immune stimulant they used was an injection of bolus peptides that mimicked a vaccination. The virus, in other words, raised an under-the-radar immune response, rapidly left the blood, and settled into tissues. It could be a stealth invader. Nobody knew whether these individuals with no knowledge of their XMRV infection were walking time bombs, waiting for an immune crisis that allowed the retrovirus to emerge from hiding to cause significant damage. Harvey Alter and Shai-Shing Lo of the FDA presented an abstract of their paper previously published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that had confirmed Mikovits's work and caused such consternation the previous summer that its publication was delayed for several months. They reported, "We found MLV-like virus GAG gene sequences in 32 of 37 patients, 86.5%, compared with only 3 of 44, 6.8%, healthy volunteer blood donors. No evidence of contamination with mouse DNA was detected in the PCR assay system or any of the clinical samples. 7 of 8 GAG-positive patients were again positive in a sample obtained nearly 15 years later. Mikovits and her team found that 67% of her well-characterized ME/CFS population showed evidence of XMRV infection. Alter and Low found evidence that 86.5% of their well-characterized ME/CFS population showed evidence of infection by a broader group of murine leukemia viruses. Mikovits and her team found that 3.7% of a healthy control population showed evidence of XMRV infection. Alter and Lowe's research showed that 6.8% of a healthy control population showed evidence of infection by this wider group of murine leukemia viruses. Statistically broken down, this meant that between 11 and 21 million individuals in the United States were potentially infected by this group of related murine leukemia viruses. The emerging picture was of a simmering plague that could take years or decades to show its explosive potential. Along with Mikovits's work, the most controversial was an abstract co-authored by Frank Rossetti and Mikovits's research associates, Max Post and Katie Hagen, Detection of Infectious XMRV in the Peripheral Blood of Children. The study contained 66 subjects, 37 parents and 29 children. 17 of the children were diagnosed with autism. A pair of 3-year-old twins had Niemann-Pick type C, a neurodegenerative disorder, and 10 healthy siblings. They wrote, "An understanding of XMRV infection rate in children may be particularly helpful, given that 1 in 100 children in the U.S. are diagnosed with neuroimmune disorders, including autism spectrum disorder, ASD, and that CFS and childhood neuroimmune disorders share common clinical features, including immune dysregulation, increased expression of pro-inflammatory cytokines and chemokines, and chronic active microbial infections." XMRV was detected in 55% of 66 cases of familial groups from 11 states. Sequencing of PCR products of ENV and GAG confirmed XMRV. The age range of the infected children was 2 to 18. 17 of the children, including the identical twins, were positive for XMRV, 58%, and 20 of the 37 parents, 54%, were positive for XMRV. 14 of 17 autistic children were positive for XMRV, 82%. This was earth-shattering news for autism parents, because along with the macaque study, it also supported the theory that these children might have been harboring an undetected retrovirus in their immune cells that could be activated through an immunization. The immune challenge of a vaccination could have offset the body's delicate suppression of the retrovirus, bringing it out of hiding. For other children, a simple fever could have begun the immune cascade that led to autism. Mikovits knew that among the autism communities, there were many who traced the onset of their child's problems to a vaccination, while others felt their child had exhibited signs from birth. An immune challenge to the mother during pregnancy could have also stimulated the retrovirus to rampage. Mikovits knew this was controversial territory. But her job was not to shy away from or even indulge controversy, but rather to seek scientific truth. In a harrowing twist, Mikovits almost didn't get to present at the first international workshop on XMRV because her laptop broke down. This would have been a tragedy since Francis Collins, head of the NIH and former head of the Human Genome Project, which was also centered in Cold Spring Harbor, and possibly the most ambitious government science project since the Manhattan Project that built the first atomic bomb, planned to sit in on her talk. She was staying at the home of her twin sister and planning to celebrate the birthday of her beloved niece, who was born the day she turned in her PhD thesis, September 6, 1991. But relaxing family plans over Labor Day weekend took a back seat to the panic that set in when her laptop crashed and had swallowed her presentation. She emailed Post back at the lab saying that she needed him to reassemble it. When she later read his emails, it was clear he had burnt midnight oil and coffee until at least 4 a.m. reassembling it. She had never met a more dedicated research associate or student than Post. What he sent to her was perfect. The meeting took place at the NIH main building in Bethesda, Maryland, in the Mazur Auditorium. Mikovits was slated to be the last speaker before lunch on the second day, followed by a short question and answer session. The session opened with an invited lecture on ME/CFS by Frank Rossetti, a talk by Brigitte Huber of Tufts University regarding her inability to detect XMRV in patient samples, Maureen Hansen of Cornell University on her success in detecting XMRV in ME/CFS patients, Lowe of the FDA on his positive study with Harvey Alter of the NIH, and finally, Mikovits on the UK patients. Francis Collins attended the opening, listened for a little while, then left. On the second day, shortly before Mikovits spoke, he reappeared, trailed by his staff, and sat quietly. Most people knew Collins for his work as director of the Human Genome Project, but others saw a less conventional side, at least for a scientist. He'd detoured from expectations by writing a book called The Language of God, in which he detailed his belief in a supreme being and a unique destiny for every living person, and a companion book, The Language of Genes, which tried to unify science and religion by postulating that an almighty creator did not conflict with his abilities as an objective scientist. With perhaps the most powerful man in the U.S. public health system sitting in front of her, Mikovits took the stage and began her talk about the patients from the United Kingdom. Her presentation followed point by point of her submitted abstract. She detailed how they'd found XMRV in a subset of ME/CFS patients in England, and they needed to develop more information about replication and pathogenesis. There was also a great need to develop tools for screening and treatments. Despite the panic of the previous day, Mikovits felt serene and confident in the middle of her talk. She had run through the important parts of her research in a steady, methodical manner. She described how her team had carefully and strategically weeded out any potential obstacles. They'd been concerned about the possibility of contamination, so after the samples were drawn, they were shipped directly to the NCI and processed in a lab that did no mouse or retrovirus work. Since their team believed patient selection criteria was likely to be the most important variable in detecting XMRV or a closely related retrovirus, they'd used the world's most rigorous definition for the disorder. She ran through the five different methods they'd used to detect evidence for the virus and noted that it appeared that for best results they needed to utilize some form of molecular or biological amplification. They'd developed a new set of primers to detect the envelope of the virus, and in following along with Alter and Lowe's work, they were finding a wider variety of genetic diversity in the virus, including xenotropic and polytropic sequences. This meant that certain strains of the virus were clearly able to infect different species. All in all, the study seemed to be an elegant counterpoint to the negative study by Jonathan Stoy and her former collaborator, Jonathan Kerr. One of the pieces of data she added to her presentation that had not been in the abstract was that approximately 5% of the controls were positive for XMRV, a number which was comfortably between their original research and Alter and Lowe's confirmatory study. Collins raised a question after her talk. He wanted to know where she'd gotten the control samples. She told him the samples had come from the London Blood Bank and were procured by her collaborator, the suddenly elusive Kerr. Collins thanked her and left the workshop a few moments later. Based on his later behavior, he must have been impressed by what he'd heard. The question and answer session was chaired by Coffin and Mikovits, with Jonathan Stoy, a protege of Coffin, serving as a kind of master of ceremonies. Eventually, Mikovits was queried on her opinion about using antiretrovirals. A commentary co-authored by Andy Mason that appeared along with the Alter Low confirmatory study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences had suggested that it was time to seriously consider a trial usage of existing and approved antiretroviral medications for CFS patients, so it seemed timely. Mikovits simply quoted the last line of Mason's commentary in part. At this juncture, studies to establish proof of principle are justified to determine whether safe antiviral regimens can impact ME-CFS. If an opinion expressed in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences wasn't good enough, then what was? A day or two after the meeting, Mikovits received word that Collins had mandated a multi-center study to be directed by Ian Lipkin of Columbia University. Unlike the planning for the first international workshop on XMRV, the WPI and Mikovits were chosen for the multi-center study. Despite the difficulties Mikovits and her collaborators had experienced the last few years, it finally looked like the ME-CFS community, and possibly other impacted groups, were finally going to get the scientific investigation they deserved after decades of limbo. The best news was that she learned the R01 grant, which she'd been in danger of losing since Kerr had lost his academic affiliation. Now it would be awarded to Mikovits of the WPI. Mikovits and Rossetti were encouraged by the positive data from Hansen, Lowe, and Alter, and all of the prostate research groups that, in often sexist science, never seemed to generate heated attacks. It was difficult to believe that these divergent groups coming to the same conclusions were all victims of exotic biology and contamination falling from the sky like some kind of blood rain. From the beginning of his academic career, Ian Lipkin was unconventional. He was in the first class of men at Sarah Lawrence College, where he studied anthropology and shamanism. Rather than pursue cultural anthropology, he wanted to become a medical anthropologist and bring back traditional medicines to the West. After medical school, he took a residency at the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, just before the AIDS epidemic began. When AIDS, known then as GRID, or gay-related immune disease, blitzkrieged the Bay Area, he was one of the few physicians willing to see patients who were infected and had one of the neurological disorders associated with the disease. The medical community would eventually realize that HIV was turning the body against itself, a hallmark of an autoimmune disease. One of the early treatments for HIV was a process called plasmapheresis, in which blood is removed from a patient and put into a centrifuge, with white cells and platelets in one area, red blood cells in another, and plasma in yet another. The plasma was known to contain antibodies that in HIV/AIDS caused part of the problem. The plasma was replaced with albumin so that the blood volume was maintained, then the blood was returned to the individual. Many patients experienced significant relief from this treatment, though they weren't cured. Lipkin thought one of his patients, a ski instructor from Vail, Colorado with HIV/AIDS, might benefit from it, but many physicians weren't interested in plasmapheresis. In a May 2012 article from Discover, Lipkin recalled those days, showing the kind of concern for patients that also made so many patients adore Mikovits. Lipkin had heard about a Russian guy at Pacific Medical Center with a centrifuge. Lipkin recalled, "He was willing to help me, provided two things. Number one, I would take responsibility for inserting the needles in my patient's arm. And two, he would be paid in cash, $600 upfront for every treatment." So I put my guy in my Ford Fiesta, and I drove him over to this medical center. He could barely walk, so I walked him in. He lay down on this hospital bed, and I put in 2 large bore needles, 1 in each arm. Lipkin then described how the man modestly improved with this treatment, was able to go skiing again, but eventually progressed to AIDS and died. It was after that experience that Lipkin decided to study infectious diseases. Although there were times when Lipkin would anger Mikovits and she would swing from gratitude to wanting to curse him out, it was always clear that the compassion of that younger Lipkin was still vitally alive in him as he got older. He did seem like he wanted to help. When Mikovits first met Dr. Ian Lipkin in his office at Columbia University in New York City on November 4, 2010, she wore a business suit, wanting to project a professional image to the group that would form the backbone of the multi-center study to determine whether XMRV was associated with ME/CFS. By contrast, Lipkin wore jeans, a button-down shirt, and sneakers, looking more like a Silicon Valley wunderkind than a senior scientist. In that meeting, in a small conference room, were Lipkin, Switzer from the CDC, Harvey Alter from the National Institutes of Health, Suzanne Vernon and Nancy Klimas, who were invited to the discussion on behalf of the patients and doctors, Dr. Simone Glynn, who was part of the already assembled blood working group, and Judy Mikovits. Dr. Kathy Laughlin of the NIH-NIAID, which funded the study, was there as well. The main issue they discussed at the meeting was which physicians would provide samples. This was when things started to go awry. The investigators were told that each of the principal investigators, Alter, Mikovits, and Switzer, could veto a decision by the group as they were the stakeholders, but this protocol quickly broke down in practice. Lipkin, who sat at the front of the small conference table, was curt, to the point, always professional, but made it clear that he had taken this assignment as a favor to Francis Collins and Harold Varmus, the head of the NCI, who wanted the study to be scientifically and ethically unassailable. Of the physicians to select study participants, it was decided that Dan Peterson's patients would be included, but that none of the original cohort that formed the basis of the original science paper would be used. Incredibly to Mikovits, the top 300 patients who she had worked with in all the WPI studies would not be included. Mikovits vehemently disagreed with the inclusion of Peterson for the simple reason that his sickest patients, those with the most dysregulated immune systems, and all of the footprints upon which she had built her hypothesis, would not be included. Her veto was denied. Next, Klimas suggested Dr. Lucinda Bateman, who Mikovits also vetoed on the grounds that Bateman was a fibromyalgia specialist and not an ME/CFS specialist, hence increasing the danger of idiopathic fatigue patients or patients without the same disease thrown into the mix. Bateman was the doctor Peterson sent his patients to when they didn't match his profile of an ME/CFS patient with natural killer cell and RNase L abnormalities who seemed prone to develop lymphoma. Bateman had participated in patient selection on a negative study already, so clearly the patients she treated were not those likely to have evidence of XMRV infection. Everybody agreed that David Bell, the physician who handled the pediatric outbreak of ME/CFS in Lindenville, New York, would be a good choice, but he had retired. Mikovits made 2 suggestions, the obvious choice of Paul Cheney and Dr. Joseph Brewer, a respected doctor in the Midwest who specialized in ME/CFS and HIV/AIDS. Both were vetoed by Klimas and Vernon, under grounds that they were controversial, as Cheney had tried to help his patients with stem cell therapy, and Brewer had suggested doing a trial of antiretrovirals. This angered Mikovits, since she knew several leading physicians were prescribing the same treatments and afraid to talk about it too loudly. Moreover, Brewer and Cheney were experienced at diagnosing ME/CFS patients with evidence of XMRV infections. The group also decided to cut from the study any patients with known thyroiditis. But Mikovits had seen an abundance of thyroiditis and thyroid cancer in ME/CFS patients and families with evidence of XMRV infection. She had, in fact, proposed the thyroid as a possible tissue reservoir for the virus. Mikovits felt that excluding this population was unwarranted. When Mikovits flew home from the first meeting with Lipkin, she thought the study was going to be a complete disaster. From the Denver airport while on a layover, she had a long conversation with Annette Whittemore where she poured out her frustrations. Unbeknownst to her, while she was safely tucked away at the meeting, Annette had announced online that VIPDX was coming out with a serological test for XMRV shortly, using Mikovits's name, but never showing her any data or asking permission to use her name on the company website. Of course, patients were excited and couldn't wait to buy in, since it would be concrete proof for their doctors. But it was the Whittemore's haste that would again cause Mikovits serious trouble. The second time Mikovits met Lipkin, she came away with a more favorable impression than the first meeting, where she'd merely felt that Climus and Vernon had run roughshod over him, and he had not fended them off and managed the meeting. Both Lipkin and Mikovits had been asked to give a talk at the New York Academy of Sciences on March 25, 2011. Opened in 1817, the New York Academy of Sciences had counted among its members President Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Edison, Charles Darwin, and Albert Einstein. It currently boasts 27 Nobel laureates. Dr. Lipkin was also a member. The event where they were invited to speak was a series of lectures on the ominous topic, Pathogens in the Blood Supply. Lipkin's talk was Microbe Hunting, and Mikovits's was Strategies for Detection of XMRV in Blood. Prior to the event, Lipkin had not discussed his presentation with Mikovits, but she had a general idea of the type of talk he was likely to give. As she listened to his presentation, it seemed to her that he had specifically crafted the perfect lead-in for her. He recounted his discovery of West Nile virus, how it had been a difficult virus to detect and caused a controversy among public health officials who had failed to take quick action, allowing the virus to spread much farther than it should have. He again reiterated his idea that most of the pathogens that were easily detectable had already been found. The future belonged to scientists who used the latest technological tools to follow the footprints of these elusive viruses and bacteria to their lairs, the true tracker hunters of virology. Mikovits felt a shiver of excitement, knowing she was on such a prestigious stage with the world's most famous virus hunter setting up her presentation. Lipkin finished up, turned to her, and said, "Go get 'em, Tiger." Afterward, Lipkin approached her and said his team wanted to take both her and Annette to dinner. They had a pleasant meal, and Mikovits saw another side to Lipkin. He talked about his role as a consultant for the movie Contagion, directed by Steven Soderbergh. The movie was a fictionalized version of the SARS outbreak in China, in which Lipkin led the investigation. Mikovits talked about Frank Rossetti and their common difficulties with Gallo. She told Lipkin she was never going to accept an order she believed was unethical or immoral, no matter who gave it. Lipkin mentioned he wanted to retire in 5 years to pursue other interests outside of science. Joining them that evening was Lipkin's collaborator, Dr. Mady Hornig, who was widely expected to take over the Center for Infection and Immunity when Lipkin retired. Hornig had a child with autism and had to excuse herself early to relieve her babysitter. By the time the dinner was over, Mikovits had warmed up to the charming Lipkin. She had seen some evidence of his reputation for arrogance at their first meeting, how he was a take-charge kind of guy, but he reminded Mikovits of her father in many ways. Once his shell was cracked, Lipkin's good heart and compassion were evident. The two of them might never become the best of friends, but Lipkin was a person she could respect, work with, and with whom she might even enjoy a lively dinner discussion. As the attacks on XMRV increased in the months after that night, and the criticisms expanded from detection of retroviral sequences being nothing more than mouse contamination, to include a recombinant virus that had been created in the lab in the early 1990s with no natural history of infection, Lipkin rose to her defense and showed his take-charge persona also meant he could hold the line for a scientist treated unfairly. When Mikovits got back from the scene at the 2011 Belgium retroviral conference, where scientists had shouted, "Stop spending money on these people," there was an email from Lipkin telling her, "Judy, ignore the noise and simply focus on the science." Lipkin was, in fact, so concerned that he offered to come out to the WPI to show his support and confidence in the work. Since it was already mid-June then, and Annette and her family always went away for summer vacation in the month of July, they had to scramble to find a suitable time frame. They settled on Lipkin flying out to the WPI from New York on June 24th and staying for 3 days. During that time, he toured the labs, conducted a physician's roundtable, and gave an open address in the WPI auditorium that was open to the public and thus expected to attract local ME/CFS patients. But Mikovits was miffed when he conducted just a cursory tour of her research lab, with a dismissive, "If you've seen one research lab, you've seen them all," and then choosing to spend a great deal of time at the clinical lab, VIPDX. She later found out that Lipkin had been very concerned by failings in the Lombardi-run clinical lab, and even wrote a 12-page letter to the Whittemores about these problems. His cursory interest in her research lab turned out to be a confidence in the quality of her work. Harvey and Annette seemed to make sure that one of them always shadowed Lipkin. Mikovits was familiar with the Whittemore charm offensive and expected as much. The night before the physician's roundtable and Lipkin's public talk at the WPI, the Whittemores hosted a dinner for him, inviting Mikovits, Rossetti, as well as Jamie Dekoff-Jones, the former emergency room doctor who had contracted ME/CFS, and about whom the New York Times reported, "Some ME/CFS patients are already trying HIV medications prescribed off-label." One patient, Jamie Dekoff-Jones, a physician in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has been keeping a popular blog about her improving health while taking antiretrovirals prescribed by her doctor. "I think the sickest patients have the right to try the drugs," she commented. Dekoff-Jones had recently been named Director of Clinical Services for the Whittemore Peterson Institute when negotiations had stalled out with Paul Cheney. Harvey gestured the server to pour expensive bottles of wine for Lipkin, who fancied himself a connoisseur, while others sipped their own drinks. The libations loosened everybody's tongues, and Lipkin started expressing opinions that offended Mikovits. Lipkin declared it was just short of criminal that some physicians were prescribing antiretrovirals for ME/CFS. Mikovits glanced sideways toward Dekoff-Jones, who wouldn't have been able to sit up for a whole social dinner in the year before she had started on antiretroviral therapies. She was living proof why Lipkin's words were dangerous. Mikovits also thought of Michael Snyderman, effectively treating both his CFS and cancer with antiretrovirals. Lipkin went on about why people like Brewer with his antiretrovirals and Cheney with his stem cells weren't serving the patient population. Mikovits soon reached her limit. She threw her napkin in the chair and stormed out, refusing to return to the table. Lipkin seemed baffled as to how he had offended her. "Well, you just insulted pretty much everything she's done in her career," declared Frank Rossetti, "including her association with me." Lipkin backpedaled and seemed genuinely contrite, promising to apologize the next day. Unlike Judy, Frank believed Lipkin's influence was so huge that they had to swallow any anger. The next day, Lipkin arrived a half hour late for the physicians' roundtable, cutting it short for Lipkin's public presentation in the large auditorium at the WPI. Mikovits felt she'd heard most of the speech before, the need to follow the immune footprints of the virus, and so on, yet smiled when Lipkin told the assembled group about the technology he possessed at Columbia and challenged, "Give me $1 million and I'll find this virus." Many local ME/CFS patients showed up for his talk. A few were being pushed in wheelchairs by caregivers with ready oxygen tanks. Afterward, many patients approached Lipkin in the lobby, shook his hand, and gushed how appreciative they were that he was trying to help. Although Mikovits was incensed about the conversation the night before, she witnessed a shift in his expression. After the group left, Lipkin approached her. "CFS patients aren't supposed to be in wheelchairs," he said, obviously shaken by how disabled they were. "The ones we see are," she answered somberly. They talked for a few more minutes, and she genuinely thanked him for coming. Harvey whisked Lipkin away to the airport, where the world's most celebrated virus hunter hopped his plane to the Big Apple.